Welcome in, episode 17, if we want to be technical. Episode 19 here of the Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun via SB Nation. Chris Abbas, as always, Jim Kokenauer on the line with us. And, you know, I know we didn't start the season around the same time that the Phoenix Suns did, but with the way things are playing out, I think we're going to finish up with about 21 to 22 podcasts. I don't want to speak too highly of ourselves, Jim, but I think we're about 21-0 or 22-0 when we finish up with these podcasts, and the Phoenix Suns are right now sitting on 23 wins. We might actually catch them.
Yeah, we could. The Suns are actually playing the Rockets right now as we're recording, and they are only up by 7 right now, but it's still the first quarter. It's early, so the Suns shouldn't have any trouble digging themselves a deeper hole than that based off a lot of their current play. And, yeah, while we're streaking in the right direction, the Suns are streaking in the exact opposite direction. They're working on getting to double digits tonight against Houston.
Yeah, and you know what? The streaks are not necessarily the funnest topic in the world, but it's unfortunately the topic of the Phoenix Suns right now, just with kind of everything that's going on and the way they've been playing as of late. And when you look at recently, so we had, since the last time we spoke, I believe there was a grand total of 3 games. Our general theory of, hey, they could probably lose all these games, but they're going to win one. We both went with the they're going to lose all 3 of them. They went out and lost all 3 of them. And, you know, losing to the Clippers on the road is not anything that anyone is overly shocked about. That's a team with championship aspirations. But, you know, went out there and played hard against Golden State, had a big lead on them. The entire game sitting in media row, basically everyone was sitting there waiting for the Golden State run. It happened, and the Suns didn't really take the opportunity to be able to come back and weather that storm. They lost that game as well. And then also losing to the New Orleans Hornets in a game where the score was a little bit closer than what the actual final result was. I mean, New Orleans was pretty comfortably winning that game all throughout. What was your general feel on this past week, which was 0-3 that is compiling on top of their 0-9 run?
They didn't play well at all against the Clippers. What was kind of an interesting stat between those 3 games is that they got outscored by the Clippers 38-20 in the third quarter, the Warriors 32-14 in the third quarter, and the Pelicans 35-19 in the fourth quarter. So they were just getting bludgeoned in the third quarter. That's pretty embarrassing right there. If you add that up, that would be a grand total of 105-53. That they got outscored in that third quarter between the 3 games. It's obviously pretty hard to win games when you're getting outscored to the tune of 52 points in 3 games in one period. And I guess maybe that's the motivational halftime speeches or something that is obviously having a rousing effect on the Suns, because you go into these games and you're close or you're winning, and then you just crumble to pieces. The loss to the Hornets was particularly demoralizing because, as we had talked about it, that was the best chance for them to actually get off the schneid and win another game this year. So that was really kind of sickening. Even from my standpoint, with the lottery and everything else in mind, I was really hoping that they'd win that. I think that they could still get that third position even with that win. And so I was hoping just to, you know, avoid some of the disgrace, the ignominy of that situation, that they'd win. But like you said, they did the offer, they did the donut.
Yeah, and you know what, with the you mentioned the Hornets game and just the way that they don't come out with any power in the third quarter, that was kind of a common thread throughout the beginning of the season with Alvin Gentry and his coaching, is that they'd play a pretty solid first quarter, or at least a solid second quarter where the game was close, they were down by a few or up by a few, and they would turn around in the third quarter and just give it all back. I mean, you all remember the Detroit game in the third quarter and the Orlando game in the third quarter early in the season, where they just kind of gave it all back to the tune of being outscored by 20, 15, 20 points in both those games and really didn't get a chance to turn it around. But you mentioned that New Orleans game was their last opportunity for a win. I'll just go ahead and throw out the Minnesota Timberwolves game still exists, and we'll get into that more with the rest of the season preview. But they are not setting themselves up very nicely to have a good season, obviously, and they're actually setting it up for, outside of the inaugural 68-69 season where the team went 16-66, they have now moved into, in the loss column, a tie with the worst Suns or second worst Suns season in franchise history with their 54 losses. So a loss tonight or one more loss for the rest of the season, and record-wise, this is officially the second worst team performance-wise with their record in franchise history. And a lot of that has to do with the streaks that they've been putting themselves in this season. Lots of losing streaks, two in particular. 7-game losing streak at home, 9-game losing streak in general heading into the game against Houston that they're playing right now. Kind of looking at these losing streaks, I mean, obviously you look at them and they're avoidable. There's games in there that they probably could have, should have won. But the thing that stands out the most to me is if they didn't beat the Los Angeles Lakers at home a couple of weeks ago, then this home losing streak would have 2 more games on it. And this overall losing streak would actually be at 15 games, or rather 14 games instead of 9 right now.
Well, the whole season has been exiguous of positive returns. There hasn't been much to cheer for, but the second half has even descended to new depths. Like you said, the losing streaks that they're mired in right now, the franchise worst home losing streak ever, standing at 7 games, and that has a good chance of going to 8 against Houston. We had talked about it, and I guess the good thing about that, if you want to look for something positive there, is that the season's over at that point. You go into a new season, and in terms of the streaks, I don't really think that they carry over from season to season that way. They lose the impact, the meaning. For instance, if a team, let's say the Knicks, I think they've won 12 in a row right now. They're going for 13 against the Wizards. If they finish out, win out, and end up at, what would they be, 18, then I don't think that carries over now that they can go to challenge the Lakers' record by winning the first 16 next year. So you do have that for the Suns, but they do have that possibility of setting the other dubious record of overall losing streak if they can lose out the rest of the season. Not only do you have these losing streaks that are demoralizing, though, but the Suns have actually been blown out to the tune of 25 or more points more than any other team since Hunter's taken over as the head coach. Only the Bobcats are even really close as far as that goes, looking at the other teams near the bottom of the barrel with the Suns. So not only are they losing all these games, but they're just getting their ass kicked. They're not even maintaining a level of effort. They're not keeping in close proximity to their opponents in a lot of the games. And we got another one of those this past week against the Clippers. They kept it respectable in the other games, but it's just a very negative tone overall emanating from this franchise. And the whole year's been bad, but I'm glad the season is coming to an end because it's just been getting worse and worse.
Yeah, and when you look at it from this perspective as well, so obviously the Suns losing streaks are unique to them, and that's something that, you know, local fans are looking at and going, wow, we've lost 9 games in a row, 7 at home. But when you look at it from this perspective, only 6 other teams in the NBA this year have had a losing streak of losing at least 10 games in a row. I'm just going to put you on the spot. Name those 6 teams. If I had told you 6 teams have lost 10 games in a row, not counting the Suns, because this would be the first time of them doing it if they did that, obviously losing to the Houston Rockets here tonight on Tuesday, but what would those 6 teams be off the top of your head, or at least name as many as you can?
Yeah, I was looking into this a little bit, so I'm going to have a couple of these. I know the Bobcats lost 18 in a row earlier this year, and I know the Magic lost 12, and I think a couple of the other teams on the bottom of that list that had lost double digits. Let's see. So besides them, the Cavs have lost 10 in a row. I think exactly 10. Actually, I think they've lost 10 in a row right now. Or no, they'd won 2 straight, but they lost 10 right before that.
Yep.
And so there's 3 of them. Who else is at the bottom of that scrap pile next to there? I don't think the Pistons had actually...
The Pistons have lost... Off. They lost 10 in a row and 8 in a row this year were their 2 biggest losing streaks. They've lost 10 in a row as well.
Okay, and then right there at the bottom, I guess my last 2 guesses then, without knowing for sure, would be the Hornets and the Kings.
The Hornets and the Wizards. The Kings have actually remarkably, I think their longest losing streak is not even 8 games, because that was my requirement looking into the losses when we're looking at the losing streaks was teams that lost at least 8 games in a row. And the Kings haven't even lost 8 games in a row for how bad they are and where they're at in the standings. Same thing with Toronto and Philly and Minnesota and Utah. All these teams that are, you know, towards the bottom or in that lottery range, the Lakers, the Mavericks, they all haven't even lost 8 games in a row despite not having ideal seasons. They've just been inconsistent. They'll lose maybe like 16 out of 17, but they'll lose 7 here and 8 there, or they'll lose, you know, 5 here and 6 here, and it looks really bad because they've lost a bunch in a row like the Suns have, but it's not in a row. They have that one win kind of squeezed in between there to kind of break up the streaks. And with the Phoenix Suns, they've lost 9 in a row. They'll enter that group if they lose to the Houston Rockets, and then against the Dallas Mavericks, that's where you have another opportunity to break the streak. Same thing going forward with the rest of their schedule. So it's not necessarily looking great for them to break off this streak. It looks like, you know what, and from a fan's perspective, when you look at it with the losing streaks, are we just getting it all out of the way now? Is this the Phoenix Suns' way of going, we're just going to be as bad as we can possibly be? Not on purpose, obviously. It's not a great collection of talent right now. But are they just being as bad as they can be now? Franchise records in losses in a row, franchise records in, you know, home losses in a row, second worst amount of wins in a season overall, you know, no guys averaging at least 15 points a game on the roster, a lot of things that are not exactly ideal for an NBA franchise. It feels like they're just getting it all out of the way, and then maybe in 2 to 3 years or whenever they get this thing back on track and they've gotten the talent level to be good again, it would make it feel that much sweeter. But for Suns fans, unless you're really, really up there in age, you only know the 03-04 Suns for being terrible, and that team was rewarded with Steve Nash the very next year. Last time the Suns were bad were in the late 80s, so Suns fans don't necessarily know how to be bad just yet. They're so used to winning 45 to 60 games. That's basically what they've been for the past 25 to 28 years. They've only really had one bad year when you look at it from that perspective of how bad they are this year. They've only had this happen to them one time, and they were rewarded with Steve Nash the very next year.
I should have got the Wizards probably, because that was back when Wall was hurt to start the season. And weren't they something putrid, like 7-31 or something god awful like that?
Yeah, they started out the season, I think it was 2-19 or something silly like that, where they had lost like 7 or 8 in a row after winning a game. Then they lost like 7 or 8 in a row again. And yeah, they were putrid before John Wall came back. And then you look at the numbers since he's been back, and one of the best defensive teams in the league, over 500, and would be an Eastern Conference playoff team. If you eradicated the pre-John Wall wins and loss record, they'd be a playoff team out in the East.
Okay, I think they had some other injuries there too, so that stymied their early season results, their charge to the playoffs, which I think they'll actually be on next year. For the Suns, though, this is completely uncharted waters for this team, for a lot of the fans, like you're saying, because I don't really count the franchise in incipient season.
Yeah,
that one, I think you can throw that out in terms of measuring how this works, because that's going to be a fact for all kinds of expansion franchises. There aren't teams that expand into the league and start off just out of the gates running. So that one doesn't really count to me. And even the 03-04 team, like you just referenced, they had promising young talent there on that team to where it gave you a lot of hope. If we had Sean Marion and Amari Stoudemire on the Suns right now, I think there'd be a huge difference in the overall mood and tone surrounding this franchise. It wouldn't be nearly as somber or morose. So, and not necessarily, obviously, those exact players, but some players, young players with the talent like that. And now they have a chance where they can get some players like that, hopefully, coming up, because right at the top of the lottery, if you can choose wisely, you have a chance to get those all-star, super talented type of players. But they don't have a whole lot to give you hope at this point. And these losing streaks, stuff like this isn't stuff that Suns fans are can relate to. The Suns, if they lose out, they'll have that franchise record there. And besides the Bobcats' 18-game losing streak, the Suns will have the second longest losing streak in the NBA for the season, the third worst record. They're just a horrible team, and we're not used to this. We're not accustomed to this. And I think a lot of the fans that are still watching have become numb to the losing and have become detached. But right now, there isn't a lot of reason to think that next year is going to be any better than this year. So to a lot of us, this just looks like the first year of this and what may turn out to be a string of these types of seasons.
Yeah, and when you look at it, one of the reasons why they haven't been very good this year, and again, on paper when the season started, I bought into it. I ate up the PR push that this was a Phoenix Suns team that was going to contend for the playoffs, that they win roughly 39 games. Hey, if they win out, they won't make me look as bad as I look right now, but clearly they're not that borderline, you know, fringe playoff team that can win 39 games like I had thought. But a lot of it has to do with the inconsistency of the way they play the players. I mean, Shannon Brown will go for, you know, 7 or 8 do not play coaches' decisions to getting on the court in the first quarter of a game and then sit out 5 more games and get put in the fourth quarter when it matters. And it just makes no sense with that. And one of the big things that me and you had been talking about as of late was Goran Dragic. I mean, when you're losing, when you're a healthy young player and you don't need to be rested, a planned season rest at the end of the season is not really necessary. I mean, if you're Tim Duncan at the beginning of the season, you circled these 2 dates and go, hey, when we have 54 wins and, you know, we reach this date on the calendar, Tim, you're sitting out 2 games. I don't care who we're playing. You're sitting out on these days. We need to get you rested and healthy for the playoffs. We don't need you to get banged up anymore. That makes sense. But Dragic goes from those 2 DNPs to just coming back and playing tons of minutes in games. And that's part of the inconsistency, is that they play guys how they want to play them. The playing is extremely inconsistent. It really doesn't make very much sense at all, especially, like I said, with Goran Dragic. I mean, it kind of is puzzling. You scratch your head when you see him get 2 DNPs for rest when he's perfectly healthy, and then he comes back and he's playing a ton of minutes, basically just spearheading the team in general, playing a lot of minutes all throughout the rest of the season ever since he came back from that rest.
The Clippers game is the most puzzling one of all, because that game was over. There was no reason for him to be on the court still. That was a complete blowout. They had got their doors blown off, and the fourth quarter was garbage time, and it was a chance to go to the end of the bench and let them finish off the game and get a little bit of burnout there. And instead they've got Goran out there when they're down by 20-plus points, getting in a fracas, getting in a fray, getting headlocked by a Clipper, and so they're keeping him out of games before that because he's too tired and he needs rest. And then he's averaging 38 minutes a game the next 4 and playing in a situation where he obviously shouldn't be. So this is all contradictory and counterintuitive. You would think, even with that they'd want him to finish out the season on a positive note because he's been playing well lately and have something to build on for next year. There's been some discussion in terms of how well he's played this year, but actually if you look at the numbers, that there's a good argument you can make that he actually had a better year last year. A lot of his numbers are really similar except for the shooting, which is markedly worse this year. But he finished last year on a real high note too. He played very well at the end of the season, and now he's playing well at the end of this season, didn't carry into this year, so I don't know whether he's just a second half player or that was an anomaly at first time and now he can carry this over. But either way, it's just another thing in a series of moves this season for the Suns that just leaves you scratching your head.
Yeah, I mean, there was the argument shortly after the All-Star break that Goran was playing at a level that was unparalleled to a lot of players in the NBA. I mean, since the All-Star break, he's put up better numbers than what he has throughout the season in general, but not alarmingly different or alarmingly better. I mean, 16 points a game, 8.9 assists. You might as well just call that 9 assists, basically 2 steals a game. So he's been playing markedly better since the All-Star break and had stretches where he had 4 or 5 games in a row, or, 5 out of 6 games where he was dishing it out of over 10 assists a game and making some runs with double-doubles. So, he's obviously their best player, but the thing is, and this is just my opinion, you can agree or disagree with it, but the inconsistency is the biggest thing. If you're going to play him, deep minutes against the Clippers when it's a blowout, you're going to put him in there for 31 minutes, including a lot of time in the fourth quarter, then, that just needs to be every game. He needs to be out there for, 35 minutes a game and let him go out there and play his 35 to 38 a game as the team's best player. But, against Houston, he plays 20 minutes, 2 DNPs in there as well, gets on the court for, only 31 minutes in that Clipper game, but you're right, he was out there late and it didn't really make a lot of sense. So, it just feels like the inconsistency is really my biggest thing. And a lot of things that Lindsey Hunter is having to learn, he's learning them on the fly. We learned that with his little war of words in the media with Michael Beasley. but he's learning a lot of things on the fly, and one of them is clearly managing his roster and managing his minutes.
Yeah, the lack of consistency there, and I think that most of us would agree that what was happening with taking him out of the two games was that they were giving themselves every opportunity to lose those games because they would have been Pyrrhic victories. There was nothing to be gained by winning those games. And I agree with that strategy. I had no problem with them resting Goran. It's, to me, no different. It's future planning. It's doing something that's prudent. It's no different than the Miami Heat resting LeBron James to try to give him a little bit of rest to prepare him for the playoffs. You give yourself maybe a chance at losing a game now so you have a better chance at doing something of greater scale later. So to me, that's smart. But what isn't smart then is to have him in the fourth quarter of a blowout game still out there. That doesn't make sense. So that is where the contradiction lies. And, you know, it's a pretty thinly veiled secret that they're trying to do. They're trying to cozen people into it. And it's really easy to see through that you're saying you need to rest him, but then yet just a couple of games later you've got him out there playing 40 minutes against the Hornets when he's not even having a good game. He's shooting 4-for-13 from the field with 4 turnovers. And so now he doesn't need that rest for the summer anymore. So he doesn't need that rest for summer basketball, and he's not tired anymore because now he's playing 40 minutes. So what they should have done is come up with some other excuse, I guess, maybe, because when they're saying stuff like this, it's just a situation of we're not stupid. So I know you can't just come out and say, hey, we're trying to lose the game, but when you go around and you say these two different things, then it's really obvious what's going on. So don't insult my intelligence.
All right, I'm just going to say it because usually you're the guy that kind of swings the sword and has no fear. You got reckless abandon with your opinions. But with those two games, let's be honest, they were against the lottery-powered Sacramento Kings who, you know, a win against them might have maybe pushed the Kings ahead of them in the lottery odds, and against the Utah Jazz that every win the Jazz get is beneficial to the Suns in terms of getting that Laker pick in the late lottery. So those two games, that's the obvious glaring reason why he was sat for those two games. I mean, could have easily sat him against Indiana and Brooklyn or, you know, other teams as they were coming in here in that same exact stretch. I mean, why not rest him against those teams? But in particular, it was them. So again, very thinly veiled. I think even with that, they kind of took the veil off and were just showing us what they were doing. And you know what? The frustration is building, and the frustration has actually kind of been there all season. But, you know, in a way, you don't necessarily want to point, you know, at the sore things as hard as maybe you should maybe in some situations. But, you know, Luis Scola came out as of late, and I'm just going to read you a quick quote, and I want to get your reaction to it, Jim. And Scola, to be honest with you, Dave put this up on the website on Brightside, where it's kind of got his transcript, you know, chronologically throughout the season of him saying very close to the same thing over and over. But basically what he said is, we just don't know how to play well. And was talking about, you know, the way that the team has been playing after the loss to the Hornets. We don't know how to play basketball, and that's why we lose. Until we learn how to play 48 minutes of basketball, we are not going to win games. I am surprised we've won 23 games playing this way. Many of the games we've won, we did the same thing. We just overcame it somehow. I'm surprised we didn't fix it. We saw the problem pretty much the first week and couldn't fix it. It's been frustrating. It's a bad year. What's your reaction to Luis Scola basically saying that for the 50th time this year, but kind of resonating now a little bit more when you look back at 54 losses and it kind of, you start putting things together in your head and it makes a lot of sense?
From his comments, and I don't think Scola is being impudent or anything here. I think he's just being candid. And there is a fine line with some of this stuff between being a malcontent by not keeping things in house and just being open with the media and stating what's, in no uncertain terms, blatantly obvious to all of us that have been paying attention. But he's kind of indicting the players for their effort, the coaches for their inability to convey a strategy to the players that they can grasp, and also not just the effort, but the coachability of the players, because obviously things aren't sinking in. So he's basically attacking the entire season from all angles almost. And, you know, it's been an abysmal season. It's been permeated by internecine issues off the court and savage beatings on it. And it started out bad, and it's just gotten worse. So it's been snowballing. And what I think is also bad about this that doesn't adumbrate favorably moving forward, that is, you know, kind of minatory going into next year, is that he's talking about the effort issue. And while I think that I've seen the team quit as a whole on at least a couple of occasions, and more instances of lots of different individuals quitting at times, I think he's mainly directing those effort and coachability comments at the younger players on the roster. And so your future there, the young players, these guys, I think they're getting the brunt of that criticism. And so how does that go into next year and give us a lot of faith and hope that we're building something good through the solid foundation of these young players when the veteran on the team and a guy that everybody respects in Scola is kind of putting them out on the spigot over the fire?
Yeah, yeah, and you know what? And one of the things that kind of stood out to me the other day was in the pregame before the Hornets game, Lindsey was asked directly, you know, hey, how do you feel about those comments we alluded to a little earlier with Michael Beasley and him poking at each other in the media? He had asked him, hey, you know, how do you feel about these comments coming from a guy that was supposed to come into this year as one of your best players? And he basically looked over at the guy, gave him one of the most sarcastic looks that you can ever give a guy, and said, who said that? We never said we're bringing him in to be one of our best players. Obviously, Lindsey's coached for 41 games, not for 82. He wasn't here at the beginning when they signed him or for why they signed him. But that's just alarming when his primary thing that he was doing was player development, and Beasley and Kendall Marshall, amongst others, obviously. But those were his two guys that he was working with to get better. And those are the two guys that he was supposed to be able to reach and connect and get on the court and get to play well. He's clearly doesn't even see him as being a main cog on the roster today and going forward. A lot of that's frustration with a losing season. I mean, at this point, they've been answering questions for 54 games from us jokers that put the microphones in their face and try and get them to say something interesting. But, you know, it's a long, frustrating season, but that kind of stood out. And you're right, Luis Scola is one of the few guys in the locker room that should draw respect from everybody. And maybe that's him lighting a fire trying to end a losing streak, or maybe that's him just going, man, I'm just throwing up my arms. I got nothing else, guys. This is just what the season has been, and it's just been a bad season. He's just kind of putting it all together there in that one comment.
For Hunter to say that shows that he's just oblivious to the entire situation, or that he's doing a massive case of backtracking and deviating from the logic, the statements made by the team earlier, because Beasley was touted as a big free agent signing this summer, and a lot of people looked at it as a risk-reward type of situation. But for him to be the fourth highest-paid player on the roster and the third highest-paid player that has played this season due to the absence of Channing Frye, which, by the way, I would like to give a shout-out to Channing that he tweeted recently that he was about 90% sure he's going to be back next season, and I still wish him the best and hope that that does come to fruition, that I'm really looking forward to seeing him back on the court again for the Suns next year. But how could you not expect more of a contribution than you've gotten from this guy? This has been the worst-case scenario that you could have possibly imagined for Beasley. And I know they didn't envision it going like this, because they would have never signed him in the first place in hindsight like this. So Hunter is being disingenuous with that remark, and either he's doing it on purpose or he's really alarmingly unaware of the situation with this team.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the culmination of this team is obviously leading towards them, you know, getting something in terms of a young asset and moving forward into the draft. But before we jump into talking about the draft and getting a look at some of the prospects real quick that are in that top five, because the Suns have, unless the lottery balls and the basketball gods hate them, have basically put themselves into the top five. That's where they're going to be. But to go back into the Beasley stuff, he's played since day one, and his numbers read, yeah, let's just look at the just straight up normal stats per game stuff. He's averaging 10.2 points a game, 3.8 rebounds a game. But he's actually, like I said, he's played from the beginning. He's gotten on the court from day one. He's played pretty heavy minutes, you know, playing in 73 games. and he was the number one free agent signing. And one could argue that PJ Tucker, the guy that they just brought off of the summer league roster because they liked his energy and brought him on as like a 12th or a 13th guy, he's actually started twice the games that Michael Beasley has started, and he's putting up numbers that are not dramatically far off of the number one free agent signing as being a guy that was brought in off of the summer league. He's putting up basically 6 points a game and 4.5 rebounds a game. He's out rebounding Beasley. He's started double the games, and he's not even known as a scorer, but he's only putting up less than, or right about 4 points per game less than what Beasley's putting up. But he shoots it dramatically less, obviously, and probably is equally as effective with the shooting techniques. But that's kind of alarming right there, is that Beasley was the guy that was supposed to come in and be the guy, and he was essentially supplanted and taken over by the guy that was brought in as a, you know, a nice, charming story from the summer league that was just supposed to be the 12th or 13th guy at the end of the bench that was just on the roster. Thanks for being good in the summer league. We appreciate what you did, guy. And he ends up being the starter and taking Beasley's minutes and being a much better player and making what, $5 million less a year than what Beasley's making this year. So
yeah,
I think that
Hunter
says a lot.
Wasn't aware that Beasley was the offseason target, the main target going into it. Some should probably tell him that the Suns were on the phone with him 1 minute after the free agency period began, trying to recruit him and obtain his services.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, like I said, I didn't want to go off on too much of a tangent with that. You know, maybe a subject for a different day. But to get a real quick peek at the NBA draft stuff, this is going to be full-fledged dedicated to the NBA draft here in about a week or two. So to give a quick update, the NCAA tournament is over. The Louisville Cardinals won the NCAA tournament, which means someone on that team has to go number one, because that's how the tournament works. So, you know, Gorgui Dieng, he's going to be the number one pick. Maybe Russ Smith will fall to the Suns at number three, because that's how the NBA draft works. You play well in the tournament, and that outrules actual talent and 30, 60, 90 games of productivity of what you've done for your career at the college level. But, you know, looking at the NCAA tournament, Jim, just throwing it over to you real quick before I give out, you know, maybe four or five guys that the Suns could be looking at in the draft. Who impressed you the most when you're looking at the entirety of the NCAA tournament, whether it was them playing for one game or them playing for six games? Who was it that went out there and impressed you?
I liked Oladipo's time that I saw him in the limited exposure. I saw a stat that a ton of players from the Final Four typically get drafted high, and I didn't see anybody in that group that was uber impressive. I thought that Louisville was the best team. That's who I had picked to win, and that's who eventually won. But that's more of a team effort and them getting away with a style that they couldn't in the NBA, where they just, you know, full court press for 40 minutes and foul people and try to get away with six of them and only get whistled for one of them in that ratio. And that obviously works really effectively for them, but that was just a deep team. So I liked Oladipo. Even in the game that they got eliminated, he still played well. I didn't get a chance to see a lot of the other guys. I tried to watch Porter, but
okay.
that didn't work out too well for me. So he didn't last very long.
I'll take that pot shot for everyone out there listening. I had Georgetown in the Final Four, so I'll accept that as kind of a pot shot at me there.
McLemore seemed like he kind of disappeared a little bit. The guys at the top of the draft that people have been talking up and are the popular guys up there near the top of the draft didn't really show me a lot for the most part in the NCAA tournament. So,
yeah, and you know what? I mean, partially that's because, you know, Kentucky didn't make the tournament, so, you know, Nerlens Noel's not there. Ben McLemore obviously disappeared. Marcus Smart eliminated right there early on in the tournament in the first couple of rounds. Otto Porter in the first couple of rounds. So most of the guys that are in the top 10, I mean, there was only two top 10 picks that had made it past the round of 16 that were in the Elite Eight. You had Michael Carter-Williams and you had Trey Burke in there. And then, you know, most of the other guys were out by the 16 or the round of 32 even. But looking at it from a Phoenix Suns perspective, when you're drafting in the top three, you can basically just fall in love with the top five or six guys. That's more than likely one of those guys is who you're going to get. When I'm looking at the Phoenix Suns, it's just basically they need the best available player. I don't think they can get positionally picky. Even when you look at, you know, their best players are arguably Marcin Gortat at center and Goran Dragic at point guard. Well, you know, if they're in a position where they're drafting and the best player on the board is someone like Nerlens Noel or someone like Marcus Smart that duplicates that position, you draft them. And for obvious reasons, because you need to influx talent into the roster. But when I'm looking at the Phoenix Suns, I would say like top five prospects to look at and kind of keep your eye on for Suns fans that really make a lot of sense for this team. I would go Nerlens Noel 1. I would go Marcus Smart 2. I would go Ben McLemore 3. I would go Anthony Bennett 4. And I'd go Otto Porter 5, probably. Anthony Bennett, he screams Larry Johnson for you old school fans out there. He's a guy that very easily can come into the league and be a monster at the 4, that undersized athlete with freak strength and good enough shooting to really go out there and be a really good player. Or he can let his conditioning issues affect him, and he can be a very, very underwhelming player at the NBA level. So we'll kind of see what he does from there. But yeah, Nerlens Noel right at the top. I would take him in a heartbeat if they were the number one pick. It does two things for you. It makes it to where you have arguably the best talent, the best prospect in the draft. But B, it makes to where you potentially can be equally as bad next year because he won't get on the court until December or January at the absolute earliest. And then, you know, you're positioning yourself very well to be around the top of that 2014 draft where maybe you can actually draft a legitimate star. And then Goran Dragic and Nerlens Noel and the rest of the roster can start to build around maybe having finally a legitimate star. So I would definitely go Nerlens Noel 1. I like Marcus Smart. I think he can play with Goran Dragic. He's a 6'4 tank at the point guard position. He can't shoot very well, but he can play one or the two. And then, like I said, you know, Ben McLemore, we all know about him. Athlete, great shooter. He just looks the part of an NBA wing. And then Otto Porter is that 5-tool small forward. But when you have Michael Beasley, Jared Dudley, PJ Tucker, a lot of these guys already on the roster, you're starting to duplicate positions. I think Otto Porter is better than all of those guys in a year or two, but you got to kind of be careful when you're extremely deep at one spot. You want to be able to play these young guys a la Kendall Marshall early in the season. So that would be my top five guys of, you know, potential Suns fans to be looking at and maybe hearing their name called on draft day.
I agree with you that the Suns should absolutely take the best player available, whatever they have on their big board. I don't think that drafting for a need is a good idea, even though they have so many needs. But even if you look at the best player on the team, which I think that would be pretty close to unanimously thought of as Goran Dragic, he's a very good starter. He's a good starter, but he's a far cry from being an all-star level talent, a guy that's going to make multiple all-star games. I would feel safe if you put the over-under on career all-star games for Dragic at 2. I'd feel safe taking the under. I think there's a chance he might make one, but there's no way he's going to be that type of perennial all-star player. He's 26, coming on 27, and that's just so atypical for players to take big steps after that it would be another near miraculous feat along the lines of Steve Nash or somebody like that. And that type of stuff just doesn't really happen. So regardless of who's there, if Smart is who they have as the third best player available and they're picking 3, then pick him. You don't want to pick for need or position and end up not taking the right guy and then having Smart become the next Chris Paul type of point guard in the league, some transcendent player, and you passed on him to take McLemore or Porter or somebody like that because it made more sense with where the roster is. What makes sense is getting talent because the roster sucks up and down. It sucks. So get talent, draft talent. I didn't get a chance to see Noel, and I've heard lots of good stuff with him. I'm not a huge college basketball buff, and I actually kind of subscribe to the philosophy that sometimes less information is better in terms of helping you make a decision than more information, and some of these players are a little bit over-scouted everything else. And just based off of measurables and a scouting report, sometimes that gives me a better perspective if you take away the name of the player and I have a better way of gauging what he's kind of worth there. The highlight reel clips don't help too much either because we could put one of those together for Michael Beasley this season and everybody would be like, oh, man, that guy's great. So I don't put much credence in stuff like that. I think from what I have heard at this point, and obviously my opinion could be wavered at some point in the future once we start doing the combine stuff and I learn a little more. But I think I agree with you that Noel would probably make the most sense if the Suns did manage to beat the system and win that number one pick over a team like the Kings or somebody else that Stern probably has that gift wrapped to.
Yeah, no, and that's I already said that before too, so we're obviously in agreement on that in terms of, you know, where they should pick and how that should work out. Now, to find out where they're going to pick, obviously we have to finish out a season and then see where the Phoenix Suns are actually going to be picking and, you know, kind of see how things are going to work out for them. And right now they're slotted number 3. And I think mathematically there's not really an opportunity to move up to the 2 spot, just basically with the wins and the losses, the logistics of the season. So the Phoenix Suns are at best going to have the 3rd best odds in the lottery. And obviously if they just go, you know, all crazy on us and win 4 out of 5 down the stretch and decide to win a bunch of games, they can move down. But looks like right now they should be slotted fairly securely in that 3rd spot with the way they're playing. They have Houston tonight. This is obviously posting here on Wednesday for you guys, but they have Houston tonight. They have Dallas on Wednesday when you guys are listening to this. They have Minnesota Timberwolves on Saturday. Those are all roadies. And then next week on Monday is the home farewell. And then they face off against the Denver Nuggets in Denver on Wednesday next time you listen to us talk. So instead of doing, you know, picks, predictions, whatever, whatnot, they have 54 losses, so it doesn't really matter how many more they have to finish out the season. The question is now this, Jim. Will the Phoenix Suns win another basketball game in the 2012-2013 season?
I don't think so. The Hornets was their last best chance. You mentioned Minnesota, but that's a road game, and the Suns are 7-30 on the road. Minnesota is a 500 team at home. So looking at the schedule, that's their last best chance now after squandering their chance at beating the Pelicans. And that's not a good chance. That's not a game they're going to be favored to win. So with 5 left on the schedule, there's still a chance that they could accidentally stumble and bumble their way to a victory here in these last 5 games. But I am going with the donut. I'm going with the opprobrious feat of finishing the season on the terrible note of garnering the worst losing streak in franchise history. It seems like a fitting end to the season to me, because it's been definitely a new experience and not one I'd like to replicate. But I guess on the one hand, you could say once you hit the bottom, there's nowhere to go but up. But I guess the Suns could still keep digging, and they could enter Bobcat Land, get some free passes, go on some of the rides there, stick around, hang out, make a weekend of it. So you never know, but I'm going with the big fat donut.
All right, Suns fans. Basically what that means is that Jim is saying that the Phoenix Suns will finish the 2012-2013 season losing 20 of their final 22 games. Man, that's tough to say out loud. Ironically, one of the teams they face, their final home game was, they did beat the Houston Rockets at home in a game where Houston kind of decided that they weren't going to show up until the 4th quarter, and then they nearly came back and won it. But yeah, you know what? We say it every single week. They could lose all these games, but I have a feeling that they'll find a way to win at least one. Obviously, if they end up losing this Houston game, Dallas is a game where it's kind of a rivalry game. They're done with the playoffs. It's a team that they've battled back and forth with over the years, primarily because of the Steve Nash connection there. But that's a game where if they put all their eggs into a basket, I think that they have a better chance of beating Dallas than they do at beating Minnesota, as you mentioned, with their home record. The Phoenix Suns are the 4th worst team on the road in the NBA season this year. If they end up losing, or rather if they end up not winning another game, they could very easily be the worst road team on the season, because that what separates them between Charlotte and Washington is one game with Charlotte and no games with Washington. So they're almost the worst road team in the NBA, and they're the 4th worst home team in the NBA, so that Houston game is not a gimme as well. So, you know, they're going to finish in the bottom 5 in home record, overall record, and road record on the season, and in points allowed. And it's just, it's been a dismal year. I kind of feel the same way as you. I do hope they end up pulling one out of there, whether it's beating Dallas or beating Minnesota. I think that'll take a lot of pressure off of these guys, and they'll feel like they did their fans right by at least getting one, so they don't run this losing streak all the way up to 15 games, because that's where it would be if they end up losing out, and that would be a franchise record in consecutive losses there. Their previous high is 14, and they could take it to 15, ironically, on the last game of the season if they lose out.
It's, like I said, it's just apropos the way things have gone. Even to start the season, a lot of us got duped, like you had said, into thinking that this team might be a little bit better than they are. Most of us had them outside of the playoffs, but most of them thought that they would at least be in that picture, in that discussion, approaching the last month of the season to where they might be able to turn on the afterburners and make it interesting down the stretch. A lot of us had them kind of in that pack and, you know, around somewhere between 30 and 40 wins, somewhere in there. But a lot of the pundits had them as the second worst team in the Western Conference. A lot of them, I can remember seeing those reports. And the Suns went out there and proved them all wrong by being dead last, by being the worst. So the Suns, if nothing else, have proved the pundits wrong this season. And I think everybody's just ready for this to kind of end like a mercy killing. So hopefully the Suns can avoid that dubious distinction like we talked about. I guess when you're listening to this tomorrow, I'm watching the game right now. I'm multitasking, just like Lon Babby. And the Suns are up actually by 2 points, just about headed into halftime. So maybe this will be the night that they pull off the unusual road victory and end the streak, halt the streak. But at the same time, I'm kind of thinking when you're listening to this, you'll have just got done reading the recap of how the Suns got their doors blown off by 15 or 20 points in the third quarter.
Yeah, so there's that in-your-face, pundits. We say that the Suns can win 30 to 40 or that they'll be the second-worst team, and they proved us all wrong. And, you know, like I said, I feel like we're 21 or 22-0 here with our podcast, with the way we're rolling. This is the 17th episode, 19th if you're counting the .5s. Thanks for listening. We'll continue bringing the podcast next week as well as the following week, recapping the season. And we'll start diving headfirst into this NBA draft stuff. So thanks for listening, and tune in next week, and we'll see how the Suns did.
Yeah, maybe we can do some end-of-season awards or something for the team. Maybe like the Darwin Awards, like the people that managed to remove themselves from the human evolution chain, something like that, some kind of gas type of thing, some kind of lampoon. Or maybe we could do some real awards.
Yeah, we'll call it the Poodcast, the awards on the Poodcast. All right, guys, we'll talk to you guys next week. Let's go.